Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Society's mind molders, the colleges, and the media, they've long given considerable attention to women's workplace issues. For example, to what extent is the fact that there are fewer women CEOs and in science, is that sexism? Or other factors, such as women opting for careers that don't require uprooting their families for promotions? To what extent is the average difference in women's pay primarily caused by sexism or of women's choices? Or should employers pay for employee childcare directly, indirectly, as in the case of paid family leave, or not at all, because it unfairly taxes non-parents and subsidizes population growth, which many environmentalists claim is the greatest environmental threat of all? Men's workplace issues, in contrast, have received far less attention. For example, 93% of all workplace deaths occur to men. Nor is it much discussed that millions of men, one in six men in their prime working years, 25 to 54, and increasing in the so-called recovery, have given up looking for work and are not even counted in the unemployment statistics, let alone seen as a problem worth focusing on. That issue, the issue of the remarkably under-discussed unemployment of men in this so-called recovery, is the topic of a brand new book. It's called Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis by Nicholas Eberstadt. Lest you think this is written by some lightweight who simply polemical, some angry white male. After completing his undergraduate at Harvard, he went on to get a master's in public administration from Harvard's Kennedy School and a master's in economics from the London School of Economics. And he's got a PhD in political economy and government, also from Harvard. He has often testified before Congress. He has appeared on NPR and on CNN. He is the American Enterprise Institute's Henry Wentz Scholar in Political Economy, Nick Eberstadt. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hey, thank you so much, Marty, for inviting me.
My pleasure. Well, how many men are we really talking about who've given up on work and so they're not counted in the unemployment rate that the media so focuses on?
If we refer just to that prime group you're talking about, the 25 to 54s, the total is over 7 million, slightly over 7 million, who are neither working nor looking for work and not counted in the unemployment statistics.
7 million human beings, each one probably, I can't imagine what it must feel like, and of course the ripple effects on their family, on their friends, and on society, more likely to result in increased, I would imagine, crime, drug abuse, etc. First of all, is that inference reasonable?
Certainly true that this has ripple effects on families. It has a huge effect on our economy as a whole because these men are not at work. The economy is growing slower. There's more economic inequality. Families are more stressed, less social mobility. There's just about nothing good in it, Marty.
But it's a zero-sum game. Some would say men have been the oppressors for decades and this is their just desserts. And so now, you know, the fact if there are X number of men not in the workplace, there are women taking their, quote, rightful place in leadership across the board. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, if you look at what's happened since the beginning of the 20th century, since the year 2000, the work rates, the employment to population rates for both men and women have fallen. So both are worse off. If you look at the previous 40 years, 50 years, while work rates were going up for men, for women, the work rate for society was also going up as a whole. So women weren't just replacing men, they were kind of supplementing. It was a win-win. Now we're in a lose-lose.
Yeah, well, I've looked at these statistics, and the labor participation rate, which is the percentage of people 18 to 64 who are working in the workforce is at 62.8% within a half percent of the lowest since early 1978. Is that accurate, by the way? I haven't looked at that in a few months.
Yes, sir. Absolutely accurate. And it's been going down, not unremittently, but down dramatically over the course of this century, at a time that we hear we're at near full employment or full employment, and when we've got more household wealth than ever before in our history. It's a very strange time.
Media reports keep talking about, you know, lower unemployment rate and a, quote, recovery. Am I correct? I read in The Atlantic about a year ago that, in fact, the number of men in that men 25 to 54 in the so-called recovery is increasing. Is that accurate or is that inaccurate? Please tell them, you know, don't pander to the host. What's the truth?
Well, it's coming up very slightly. It is not still spiraling downward. We have bottomed out, more or less flatlined, and we're seeing a little bit of an increase in the work rates and for men in this critical group. But compared to what? If we compare the work rates for men today to the work rates for men in 1940 at the tail end of the Depression, they're worse today than they were in 1940, not just for this 25 to 54 group, but for 20 to 64. So we can really talk about this as being sort of a Depression-scale problem.
Let's talk about that group that doesn't get discussed. We kind of dismiss, we truncate the distribution at 54, but there's a hell of a lot of men, 55 to 65, who, A, they're, you know, men have conditioned genetically, whatever the hell it is, have believed that work is central to their identity, to their sense of worth, and we see study after study that say that men don't save enough for retirement, so they need to work. What do you know about men from 55 to 70?
Well, this is an interesting thing. Over the age of 55, we've seen the work rate and the labor force participation rate for men stabilize after dropping for the whole post-war era, and now it's actually coming up. The only good news story for guys in the economy in the last two decades has been the rising work rates for guys who are 55 and older. And I think that's terrific because people are healthier and better educated than ever before, and if they want to work longer, that's great. But that's the only ray of sunshine in this whole story.
Okay, well, when you're gone at the end of this segment, I do what I call workovers, and people call in with their work problems. And, you know, an extremely common group of callers are men who are 40 plus, 50 plus, even 60 plus, who are, I just think it's fair to say, let's just say average in drive, intelligence, whatever. They've been managers. They have some technical skills, but they're a little tech light. Are you in a position at all to offer advice to that cohort of people, or are you more of a statistician type guy?
Well, I'm a complete nerd. I mean, I've never done anything in my life except been a researcher.
Who cares about your opinion then?
Some people would say I scarcely have a job.
Well, am I right? You don't really have an opinion about that question?
No, I couldn't offer any help on informed opinion.
Well, let me ask you about, I mean, a nerd. You know, tell me about that just for the fun. This has nothing to do with anything, but this is a show about careers. So,
I started in college, and the first...
No. Go back earlier.
I took on population, and I thought this demographics was incredibly fascinating, and I guess a couple of us have to think that, and I've kind of stuck with that since the early 70s and, you know, trained in it, and luckily enough, I was able to find a way to make a living in this area. So I'm doing something that I absolutely love, and it's wonderful to be able to get paid for doing something you absolutely love.
Go back earlier. I'm curious, you know, when was the first nanosecond when Nick Eberstadt felt that there was the first clue that he should be a data nerd?
Well, I mean, I always loved science and math and stuff in school. I mean, I was one of those strange people who liked school, but I didn't feel trapped in it. But I liked science and math, but I didn't know for a fact that I'd go into it. I mean, I thought at one point when I was going to college, I was either going to go into chemistry or history of art. So, you know, I... You know, I can't tell you.
History of art. Anyway, you listen to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking with Nick Eberstadt. He's the author of a brand new book, Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis, indeed invisible. One in six men, 25 to 54, and at least slightly increasing in the so-called recovery, are out of work and have given up because they can't find a job, and thus they are not mentioned at all in the media. All the media talks about is the, quote, unemployment rate that continues to drop and doesn't discuss the 7 million men who have opted out. Interestingly, your book reports surprisingly that immigrants are less likely to have left the workforce. Any thoughts on why?
Well, there are two groups across the board, regardless of ethnicity or education, who seem to fare very well. And one is immigrants. Doesn't matter if you're white, black, Asian, Latino, and you're a guy, you're more likely to be in the game than a native-born guy. The other group is married men with kids. Doesn't matter, if you're black, Latino, Asian, white, doesn't matter your educational level.
Sure, the pressures are great.
I think those are signals for motivation, I guess.
Right. If you've got married and kids, you're feeling extra pressure. You can't play video games even, It's harder to give up when you've got screaming children and a screaming spouse.
So motivation, I mean, it isn't the wedding ring and it isn't the green card. It's just that I think a whole bundle of attitudes and viewpoints come along with those.
Okay. And I guess because there is a bimodal distribution of the kind of work that's available.
Yes.
The very high-level PhD types who are immigrants, are able to find, more likely to find work than the average, less likely to opt out. And there's always a need, with so much automation, the only jobs that are kind of left are kind of the very low-level jobs for which there is a high level of demand. Is that a fair inference on the white immigrants?
Well, it's a very strange situation today, Marty, because if you the received understanding is that if you have less skills, if you have less education, you're more likely to be out of work and out of the labor force. And that's generally true. But if you take a look at guys with less than a high school degree who were born abroad, mm-hmm. they've got the same work profiles as college grads, and they're 25 percentage points higher than the labor force participation rates of native-born high school dropouts.
Yeah, but to follow the stereotype, isn't that just going to be, people who are working landscaping, hotel cleaning, and all the rest of it at low wage? Is that...
it may be low-wage stuff. I mean, some of it's going to be low-wage stuff if it's low-education stuff, but it's also construction and things which, which pay pretty well compared.
That's what I've seen. 20 years ago, the carpenters were making $25 an hour. Now they're making $12. That's a gross increase.
Well, one of the things which has also happened is there's been this, and you must know all about this, the explosion of disability program participation. We've got over a half of these guys in this army of 7 million who are drawing one or more benefits from a disability program.
Wow.
And about a million out of these 7 million are getting two or more different program benefits from different disability programs.
Okay, well, some would say that's
almost
great.
Almost like an alternative lifestyle to the old working life.
Well, in some ways, it's like a guaranteed annual income. But some would say it's wonderful that we are radicalizing, if you will, the public to demand the services they need if they're disabled. Others say that it's a sign of more malingering. I know you're a data guy. Is there any data to suggest to what extent, there's always truth in both sides, but...
Sure. Well, I'll tell you what I see, and I find this really troubling. We, a nation, do these things called time use surveys, Bureau of Labor Statistics. What do you do from the morning, from the moment you wake up in the morning till the time you go to bed at night? Mm. For the 7 million guys, about a tenth are adult students, training to get back in the game. Mm-hmm. Their time use patterns look like, working guys. The other 6+ million, less help around the house than working women, unemployed men, even employed men, less volunteering, less religious activity. Mm-hmm. They don't do civil society. What they report doing is spending more than 2,000 hours a year watching television, internet, mm-hmm. handheld devices.
Video games, right?
Yeah.
Getting high.
About a third of them report taking illegal drugs.
I see, right. I mean, you know, I need to have a little sympathetic view to them. If I were looking for work, my unemployment's run out, nobody yep. wants me, except for some really crappy job that it just feels, you know, horrible, and I'm spat out, and every time I turn on the TV, all I hear about are women are heroes, men are monsters, you know, and I'm looking at that, and all I want to do is I want to get high, I want to play a video game and escape into the world of Narnia or whatever, it is. What percentage of the guys are Mr. Moms? You know, the media keeps extolling all these Mr. Moms out there. How much of that? You said there wasn't much domestic, you know, house cleaning stuff. Mm-hmm. How much Mr. Mom activity is going on?
Well, if we wanted to round it to an even number, zero.
wow.
According to the surveys, about 2-3% of the guys who are not in the workforce say they're not in the workforce. This is 20-64, not just that 25-54 group. Mm-hmm. Say that they're not in the workforce because they're caring for other people, children or others. For women, it's 40%. Mm-hmm. For guys, it's like 2-3%.
Interesting.
And, you know, so it's a chasm. It's just like a totally different. So it's like, you know, women are from Venus, men are from Mars or something. It's completely, mm-hmm. you know, couldn't be more different.
It is amazing. When I watch the media, all I'm showing are either there be commercials or shows in which men are nurturing, they're holding the baby, men are cleaning, men are making the meal, men are whatever. It's just another media illusion. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I mean, I think that maybe people who are. Do that anyhow. Maybe people do that as part of their regular lives. But the men who are specifically not in the labor force in order to care for somebody else are, you know, you can find them, but you can find them because there are 7 million guys in the pool. But you have to be pretty selective.
Sure. Right. Okay, so more on the media here. The media reports tend to blame men's tough time in the job market on the decline in manufacturing jobs. But your book reports that maybe one of the more surprising pieces of data is that the problem is worse in the United States than in other countries that have done a lot of manufacturing. So what other factors are causal other than the decline in manufacturing jobs?
Well, I think the biggest overlooked factor, and this one really startled me when I was trying to put this whole puzzle together, is the rise of the what we might call the criminalized population, people who have felonies in their background. Mm-hmm. There are about 20 million people and 20 million adults, most of them men, obviously, in America today, who have some sort of felony conviction in their history. Mm-hmm. And we don't collect information on this at all. Mm. But I went out and tried to do a little bit of homework, and it looks to me as if people who have prison time or felonies are way, way, way more likely to be out of the labor force than people who've never had trouble like that.
So again, some would say the liberal argument would be that we have mass incarceration and there is, you know, just like an extension of, you know, the Black Lives Matter, that their cops are shooting people and rounding them up and targeting neighborhoods. And then the conservative argument would be there is ever more poor people who are unable to compete in the ever more tech-centric, more demanding job market, and there's a greater sense of entitlement, and so it's that. Do you have any data, not opinion, but data that
well,
support?
I'll tell you what I was able to find. I found one little survey that gets at this, and on the basis of this one little survey, National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, you can see that it doesn't matter what the guy's age is, it doesn't matter what his ethnicity is, it doesn't matter what his educational background is. If he's been to prison, he's more likely to be out of the labor force. If he's been arrested ever, he's more likely to be out of the labor force. If he's never been in trouble with the law, he's much more likely to be in the labor force.
Sure. Well, of course. But, of course, you know that the Obama administration has recently come up with, quote, recommendations with teeth to employers that say, you know what, be very careful before you have a policy that doesn't allow felons to apply for jobs because it has a disproportionate effect on minorities. And we're going to be taking a close look at that. Mm-hmm. And of course, non-felons are saying, what? I can't even have any advantage in the workplace because I didn't commit a felony? What are your thoughts about that issue, if in fact you're right, that people who are felons are less likely to be employed? Any thoughts on that really hot issue?
Well, I haven't done the work to be able to tell you why people who have felonies aren't in the workforce. I can't tell you if it's discrimination or if they've lost skills in prison or if the type of people who are likely to get in trouble are just not likely to be good you know, labor force people. But I do think that if people have paid their debt to society, It's probably a good thing to try to get them back into the economy and back into society. We've seen the number of people with felonies in their background skyrocket over the last 20 years at the same time that the crime rate has dropped really dramatically. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm always worried about the menace to society question myself, but it looks to me like this greater growth of a criminalized population hasn't led to a crime wave, so, you know, we can look at how to reintegrate these people, maybe.
You're
listening, we need the data to see what works, and we don't have it.
I'm just curious what you would say to somebody, you know, there are these 7 million men you're talking about, man, most of them are non-felons, and yet they're having a, they've given up, they can't find a job, and now they're being told that felons are cannot be disadvantaged in the job market, and they're saying, what do you say to me? I've tried to live a good life and not commit crimes, and here I am told I don't have an advantage in looking for a job with compared to a felon?
Well, I think our social welfare policies for disability are actually kind of insane. Of course, we need to have disability policies because people are disabled.
Yeah.
But we don't want to have it as a sort of a incentivized alternative to work. What I think we want to do is kind of, as I understand it, what some of the Nordic countries do, where they have a social welfare policy that's a work-first policy. So if you don't have a job, if you're out of the labor force, you get training. You get job placement. You are incentivized and disincentivized for showing up to your job once you get it. But it's got to be geared towards getting men back in the game. I mean, it is it's horrific that we've kind of ignored this gigantic swath of our population and treated them as dispensable. It's horrible.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Nicholas Eberstadt. He is the author of a brand new book called Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. And although we talked about 7 million unemployed people, the cover of the book actually has a graph that shows 3 million unemployed men in 1964 and 12 million now. What's the difference between the 7 million statistic and the 12 million on your cover of the book?
Okay. Well, so that's the percentage of prime age men not working or looking for work. So that's gone from about 3% to about 12%.
Oh, percent. Got it. I see.
That's what it was. But Marty, let me tell you one thing, which drives me nuts when I hear it. You know, every month, the labor force. The monthly labor force numbers come out, and everybody looks at the unemployment rate.
Right.
For every guy who is in this prime group who is unemployed, there are three guys who are neither working nor looking for work.
Wow.
So if you just look at one instead of the three, you just have a completely misrepresentative view of what's going on.
Dear listeners, that's very, very important. So when you celebrate that the unemployment rate is now 4.9%, realize that for every one man who was counted in that low unemployment rate, there are three who have given up looking for work. I am a member of the media, and yet I feel if my allegiance is primarily to the cosmos, literally, and not to the entity with for whom I work. Really, I mean, if really the unvarnished statistics from this guy who's got a Harvard bachelor's and PhD, and he's a named scholar at the AEI, and he's, you know, he got a master's from London School of Economics, he studied it for 30 years, and he's telling us that the statistics really are that there are three men, who are unemployed and given up for work, who are not counted in the media reported statistics, it should be one of the million wake-up calls that when we watch or listen to the read the media, that there are very powerful filters that are operative. Let me ask about that. A number in the media, well, let me say it this way. Why do you think for decades now more attention has been paid to women's workplaces, women's pay, childcare, paid parental leave, underrepresentation in top executive positions, underrepresentation in science, and so little paid to the fact that there are three men who have given up looking for work for everyone that's counted. One in six men from 25 to 54. Why do you think this has been so under-discussed?
I have two hypotheses.
Okay.
The first hypothesis, of course, is that men are not a designated victim group. And there's long reasons in history why they're not a designated victim group. You know, they're supposed to be the strong ones, the providers, all of that. That's one reason. Another reason, I think, has to do with the nature of our society. One of my colleagues at AEI, Charles Murray, gives this wonderful thing which he calls the bubble test. Do you live in a bubble? I think more and more people in the media, in Washington, in top ranks of decision makers in business, don't know people who are in the bottom half of our society. And if they knew people who were in the bottom half of our society, they sure would know up front and personal about this men without work problem.
Absolutely. That's as a career counselor, and I do have a largely middle class population, but I can't tell you how many men are in tears and or furious that they feel they are completely ignored. There's endless programs for everybody but them. And they can't find a job, and they bought the American dream, and they got the college degree, and they took on the student debt, and they played the stupid corporate game, or the nonprofit game, or the government game, or whatever, and then they reach 45 or 50, and because they're not stars, these are the people who come to see career counselors are generally not the stars. The stars have fine work. But the average, or heaven forbid, 50% of people by definition are below average. Those people are really getting spat out, especially if they're over 50, and they are furious. And unless I had, and I grew up in, really in a tenement in the Bronx, that's really the truth. And so I grew up with it, and as a professional now, I see some of it, and I actually was a teacher in Richmond and New York City with really, really well below, you know, socioeconomically at the bottom 10%. And I see how much misery there is there. Some of it is deserved, it isn't all just externalities. But the problem is far bigger than what the people in the bubble, as you say, the media people who it's very easy to pontificate from on high. I dare them to go into an inner city high school or dare them to go into a rural workplace, a rural town and make the same pontifications, pious, so confident pontifications about to the cause of the problem. What do you think?
Getting out more.
Right.
For
you know,
sure.
Let me give out the phone. Let me let our listeners ask you a question or two. I have a couple more questions for you. But, dear listeners, we're talking about the fact that one in six men, 25 to 54, and slightly increasing in the so-called recovery, are out of work and have given up. And one out of for every one that's reported in the unemployment statistics at the media trumpets, there are three who are not counted. If you would like to ask a question or even briefly tell your tale from the trenches, if you will, on men in the workplace, your thoughts, we've tried to be as honest as we can in this interview. I drew my best to not pull punches. Because I do think that's one of the things that we're all so pious, especially here on public radio, we're so careful. And I think there is a truncation of discussion that goes beyond the orthodoxy. So I invite you to call the phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco. And my guest, Nick Eberstadt, who is the author of Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You know, a number in the media don't decry. So one of the reasons I think that the media ignores is not just they're in the bubble. They actually extol the decline of men in the workplace. For example, New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd wrote a book called Are Men Necessary? Bill Clinton's press secretary, Dee Dee Myers, wrote a book entitled Why Women Should Rule the World. When Washington Post columnist Kathleen Parker was writing the book Save the Males, her editor said, why write that? Your next book should be Shoot the Bastards. The cover story, I got to do one more because it's so powerful. The cover story of a Father's Day issue of The Atlantic, one of our most prestigious publications, was Hannah Rosen's The End of Men. Its core contention is that men are better suited for, and these are the words she used, the Neanderthal era and Industrial Revolution, when success usually depended on brawn and individual testosterone, and here's her word, testosterone-poisoned competition. Rosen argues that today's success requires women to be in charge. She writes, for example, this quote, men are women's new ball and chain. Can you imagine that some guy said that women are a ball and chain? End quote, and continuing to quote, maybe male DNA is shifting. Maybe they're like those frogs. They're more vulnerable or something, so they've gotten deformed. End quote. Imagine a man saying that about a woman. So why should we, you know, maybe, look, these are the most prestigious publications in the world. You know, the New York Times, Washington Post, The Atlantic. So maybe they're right. Why should we care that so many men have given up looking for work?
Well, I mean, you know, there's always a kind of a poison of political correctness. And I think that in 30 or 40 years, people are going to look back on that and see that, you know, for the embarrassing nonsense that it is. And I think that most ordinary real people understand that it's not a zero-sum game, that men can do well while women are doing well, and it's better for everybody to have have both men and women be successful, or to have successful families, to have a successful society. It's not zero-sum.
Well, let's see what our normal listeners, who are not going to give us embarrassing orthodoxies, have to say or ask for you. Nick Eberstadt, the author of Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It is your turn on the air. What is your question for Nick Eberstadt?
Yes, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
With these new means of communication that we have, it's much easier to find out what's going on someplace else and therefore make real comparisons. I was intrigued by the guest's observation that in the Scandinavian countries, when someone has committed a crime, there's a different attitude towards encouraging them to get back into the workforce after they have paid their debt. On the other hand, Marty, you quite correctly said, well, hold it then. People who have not been convicted of a crime will say in our country, well, why should that not count? And it seemed to me that it probably reflected some difference in the way in which the people in the two different areas look upon society and their fellow people in that society. And I would appreciate any insights that the guest might be able to provide for whether there are such differences about the way that people look upon the people in their own countries.
Nick?
Sure. Well, actually, I was talking not specifically about offenders and felons. I was talking about men who are out of the labor force and the work first principle in trying to reintegrate non-labor force men back into the workforce. Scandinavia does have very progressive rehabilitation policies. I'm not quite as familiar with them. I think it's true that the United States is a much more violent society than any of the European societies. And that's true by ethnicity. You can break it down by black, you can break it down by white, Latino, and so forth. And so we probably can watch what goes on with criminal justice in some other places in the world and learn to some degree, but we are an American exceptionalist country with respect to crime and violence as well, I'm afraid.
Anyway, I want to thank you. No, before I even thank you, I'm aware of your point. Your point is, while America is certainly moving to more an egalitarian viewpoint, if there is something that is essential about the zeitgeist, is a reduction in the individualistic, Reaganistic, John Wayne cowboy, you know, individual initiative, capitalist approach. We're still not Scandinavia, and you were reaching to my guest to try to see if there was more about that communitarian mindset that should be adopted here. Was that what was really implicit in your question?
Yes, yes. And when your response to him, which was very appropriate, I thought, was to cite the situation of the person who doesn't have a felony conviction and then would say, well, hold it, why shouldn't that count? I've kept my nose clean for this whole time. So there is apparently some sort of difference, and I was interested in knowing from an expert on research whether he had been able to discern any larger feature of a society that would reflect.
Yeah. Well, the Scandinavian histories are, you know, every country is, you know, for better or worse, caught and prisoner to some degree of its own history. The Scandinavian experiment with communitarianism really began with World War I, because before that time, Scandinavia's policy for dealing with the poor was to send them to the United States. It was migration. Once World War I made it impossible to go back and forth across the Atlantic, the societies had to start focusing on what they were going to do, you know, with people in their midst. And that was how the Swedish Third Way came about, and similar policies and approaches came to the other Scandinavian countries. I guess Finland's a little bit different there. But all of that kind of changed very gradually, and as you might expect, these sorts of things are big historical shifts, and big historical shifts, you know, happen over big historical time.
Well, as usual, I really love your calls. Your calls over the years, you know, obviously I know I can recognize your voice. They're ever more intelligent, ever more circumspect, ever more looking at multiple sides. You are truly an honored member of the Work with Marty Nemco workforce. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you very much, Marty. I very much enjoy the show. I guess it's obvious because I listen to it all.
So many years. You know, your voice is distinctive, and I've heard, I remember in your earliest calls many years ago, it was all about looking to play gotcha, and I'm just sensing now you're trying to get to much more, to more light than heat, and you're really, I appreciate your calls every time you call.
Thank you, Mark.
Take care. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. What is your question for Nicholas Eberstadt, the author of Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis? Hi, it's you.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello. I was fascinated by the author's book, Men Without Work, and the huge numbers of men without work. And that the media, and what you said, Marty, and Nick said also, that the media is in a bubble with regard to these statistics, and the government is in a bubble with that and doesn't announce that. Does this also carry over to our political situation? And will Trump surprise everyone because these numbers of men without work will be huge and people will be dissatisfied and vote for him and he'll win?
I don't think so, but Nick, I don't think he has a chance. But anyway, I think in the debate he's going to get destroyed because he is dangerous. You know, I'm not some wild leftist, but he is dangerous, inexperienced, and I think Hillary is a very articulate debater, very smart, very calm, which is what we need. We don't need hotheads. So that's my opinion. Nick, what do you think?
Well, I mean, neither of them. Trump may have profited politically from some of this men without work stuff. But I don't think that either of them has really addressed this question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Hillary Clinton will talk about inequality and reducing inequality, but not the men without work part of it.
Sure.
Trump doesn't have a plan in this area. And actually, if he becomes president and we have these wonderful trade wars with China and Mexico and whomever else, we'll have a whole lot more men without work.
Yeah. I'm happy to take any and all bets on the election. I am well aware. I looked at 538.org this morning, and it still shows like 59% chance for Hillary and 41% for Trump. But
yeah.
I think that after the debate, it will become ever clearer.
Yeah.
I really think that while he's a much bigger embarrassment, I really think they are both not the best that this country could select, and the problem is our electoral system, in which you have to run this gauntlet of 4 years of pressing the flesh, raising a fortune, BSing, saying one thing to one subgroup and one thing to another. The finest people who should be running this country are deterred by the process. And I know that's a side peck, but we're getting into election season, and I'm not taking sides. I'm not voting for either of them, to tell you the truth. But it is an embarrassment to me. Is that you're in Washington D.C. You're in the belly of
the
political
the
beast.
Bubble.
Yeah,
bubble,
in the bubble too, dude. So yeah. You know, is not the election process an embarrassment?
Well, I mean, if you ask regular Americans indicate, of course, it's an embarrassment. You've got two candidates, both of whom have less than 50% approval. I mean, how do you end up with a situation like that?
Well, even if I'm not as noticed, you know, there's 79% of people believe in angels. It doesn't mean we're going to use a majority in terms of, you know, but in terms of, I think in terms of, I like to use the word cosmic. In terms of cosmic justice, what will be best for humankind? To think that these two people are the best people qualified to shepherd the most powerful nation in the world does scare me. It really does scare me. And not that I think the minority candidates, you know, the either Jill Stein, the Green, or Weld and Johnson, the Libertarian, you know, I don't think they're the magic answers either. I think our process is broken. We need, I don't know, maybe we need a philosopher king or something. And I even have questions about democracy. Is that, you know, when you've got the democracy so easily manipulated by commercials and sound bites and the Donald Trumps of the world, doesn't that mean that, I mean, is democracy really what is going to be ultimately best for humankind? I'm not so sure. I know this is off topic, but what do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't know what's going to be better than a democracy. I mean, what you do see is that at the turn of the century, back in 2000, about three quarters of people in America thought that things were more or less okay, or more or less going in the right direction. And now only one out of four thinks it's going in the right direction. So something has happened really wrong in the last 15 years.
Okay, this takes us where we should come to a conclusion. So let's get to this core question. I never like to discuss a problem without solutions. So I want you to put on your statesman hat. You're not an ideologue for any side. You're being the wise man, if you can. What should government and or the private sector do about the fact that both the micro question of that one in six men, 25 to 54 and increasing, are unemployed, and one in three men are not counted in the unemployment statistic who are out of work? What would the wise man, Nicholas Eberstadt, do?
Probably, if it takes 50 years to create a problem, it's going to take a while to fix it, so you got to be patient.
Sure.
But I would think of three different things for government and then other things that government can't do.
Great.
The three things that government can do, I think, is to help revitalize businesses, especially small businesses, for job creation. Mm-hmm. We now see net death of businesses, more businesses being closed than, you know, being opened, and that's kind of terrifying.
What would that look like? What would be one plank in your revitalization platform?
I think probably going through regulations and making regulations on businesses less expensive and onerous.
Let me take the liberal position on, which would be, you know, the one topic that does not get, the most important topic that does not get taught in schools and in colleges is ethical entrepreneurship. So what if we said replace some quadratic equation instruction with ethical entrepreneurship? That might more constructively be viewed not just by, you know, conservatives, of course, are going to love the deregulation idea, but I would think that both left and right could embrace the idea of better entrepreneurship training. You buy that?
Look, any type of entrepreneurship training, ethical entrepreneur training sounds great. Also vocational training. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's insane that we don't have a vocational track for our men and women. But I'd say doing probably a whole panoply of things to try to revitalize business. I would turn disability insurance upside down and try to make it into a work first program rather than a, you know, incentivizing helplessness sort of program.
Tell me about that. What would that look like?
I think we'd probably have something that would look a little bit like the welfare reform for single mothers back in the 1990s, where we'd want to try to get people into job placement, into training. It might be more expensive than the disability system we have now, but if it could be effective in helping people get back to work, I think it would be very beneficial.
So let me try to flesh that out.
We've got a big federal system, so we could experiment with different things
right.
in different places.
So the notion is somebody applies for disability, they say, I got injured on the job, or I'm mentally disabled or whatever, that before they can get cash benefits, they've got to try some kind of a job retraining program
or
that would accommodate their disability?
Or maybe after a year. You know, you see how people are doing, and then you try it. I don't have a particular program that I can point to on this. I think the concept is a good one and should be experimented with.
You said there was
and
a third.
The third government thing is collecting statistics on our ex-prisoners and felons, seeing how they are doing or how badly they are doing, how they're doing in the workforce, how they're doing in other things, and trying to figure out what sorts of approaches work to reintegrating them back into the labor force. We don't even have the information on knowing whether some things are working and some things aren't working. I mean, it's We're basically like back when Tocqueville came to America and was looking at prisons. We don't have any more data than he had.
Well, I seem to remember reading quite a bit of data that felons do very poorly when they get out of prison. Their recidivism rate is high in part because of that. What has always struck me as a smart approach, I always like to take a strength of an individual and build on that. Well, there is a strength that felons have. They understand felons. Not all felons are alike, of course, but they understand a fellow felon more than somebody else. So if I was somebody who was a serial burglar, and I would always be breaking into people's houses through the back door and whatever, and fencing my merchandise and whatever, I think that it's carefully selected. Some people really do say, you know what, I'm sick and tired of my criminal life. Those people could be some of the best counselors of all. Some perfect middle-class non-felon person trying to talk with somebody who's a career criminal and get them to be straight is garbage. It ain't going to happen. There's going to simply be a natural tendency to rebel simply because I'm so different. But if one of their own, if you will, and of course I'm talking across race, gender, sexual orientation, everything else, but if somebody who's got a similar background, similar mindset, sits down and talks with them, that's going to have a lot more credibility. So I wonder if there's this whole cohort of people who are felons who might be the best counselors in the world. What's your reaction?
No, that's a very interesting idea. It's a very interesting idea.
You said there were three. There were things that the government can't do.
So those are the government things. And then the things the government can't do, family, strengthening the family. I think that's something which would help. I mean, it's obviously a virtuous circle. But if families were stronger, I think it would be easier to see more men, you know, looking for work and in the game. Probably also.
I want to stop there. I got to push back. I know that's a nice little sanitized activity. Sure, if we had more two-parent families, but you know, forcing the kind of families to stay together who have opted to separate, either because they were married and realized the husband was an abuser or they simply couldn't get along, raising a two-parent family, raising kids badly, or beating the hell out of them. How many parents beat that crap out of their kids? I would rather see a single-parent family who with one good parent than two bad ones.
No, look, I'm not talking Ozzie and Harriet. I mean, Ozzie and Harriet are pretty far gone.
Yep.
What you do see, though, is that although the work rates for men of every marital status have worsened over the last 50 years, it's for the never married guys and the guys who don't have children or don't have their own children at home where the work is work profile is the most dismal.
Right.
So, I mean, it's stronger. Stronger families are stronger work, I think. So I don't know how to do it, and I don't think the government should touch this. This is something that only civil society can come up with.
I'm going to make a liberal argument. I'm going to take there were government solutions. Unfortunately, I used to be a huge fan of parenting education, pre-parenting. They had these dolls that were computer programmed, and they would give them to all these girls and show them how difficult it is to be a parent. You know what? A lot of these girls, especially the ones who are from, quote, vulnerable populations, ended up liking taking care of this computerized baby that's crying all the time. So that's not the answer. But I do think pre-parenting education to figure out what works to deter teen pregnancy is a great thing. And I also think that I think we romanticize what it's like to be a teenage parent. Oh, and birth control. That was the other thing. Right. So de-romanticizing in whatever ways I don't think we know. The dolls aren't working, the computerized dolls. But to de-romanticize it and to give people alternatives. I think people get pregnant and don't have an abortion because they think that's what's the best thing that they got in life. If they're doomed to a McJob, they say, I'd rather have a baby to love me and me to love. So de-romanticizing. Better jobs especially for the vulnerable, even if it is government-created jobs, and then birth control. We are having more birth control available in the schools, but I think no restrictions, birth control availability, and really thoughtful birth control education. Nobody knows more about this than Planned Parenthood, and I think getting Planned Parenthood to be in collaboration with the schools at the junior high school level when they're still more formative than when they're at the high school level and their views are more ossified, I think that's going to avoid premature single parenting and parenting in general. What's your reaction?
Maybe. I mean, we now have the good situation where we've got a drop in abortions. Well, we've got a drop in abortions, also a drop in births. So people are being a little bit more careful than they were in the past, and that's all for the good. I mean, the other thing which I haven't mentioned is religion. And I think that probably there's a whole big role for faith in this.
Yeah.
I think that's right. For, you know, different sorts of houses of worship and so forth.
How does that tie in? I'm an atheist, so forget about me. But
I think it ties in through all of the sorts of evidence that people who tend to be, you know, Arthur Brooks's work on religiosity and happiness and civic participation and stuff like that. These are big general tendencies, of course, and every individual is an individual. But I think if we had stronger families, and probably if we had more stronger faith in the United States, those are things the government shouldn't touch. Either of those, I guess. I think. But if we did have them as a thought experiment, I think that we probably would have a little bit more advantage in dealing with this men without work question.
I think it's going to be targeted. The truth is, educated folks are much, much less religious because they just, you know, they're quite aware that there really is no God and et cetera. But poor people find a great deal of peace and comfort and community and rules and structure and morality, et cetera, through church, through religion. And I think, yes, a targeted effort to encourage religiosity among those for whom that would likely benefit and not be, you know, we know the fastest growing religion in America is no religion, according to the Pew Charitable Trust. So, but targeted toward the people for whom religiosity would be a net plus relative to the unstructured, unvalued life that some people live, that does make sense. Okay. Let's, you know, we tend, because we, you know, you and I both have a certain academic background. You self-describe as a statistics nerd. I have a big part of that in my background. We tend to ignore the human side.
Yes.
So now, Nicholas Eberstadt, when you go to bed at night and you put your head on the pillow, you're a human being with feelings. So you're not just talking the abstract about 7 million men who are not only unemployed and many, 3 out of 4, are not counted in the unemployment statistics, but these are human beings and their families with huge ripple effects. There is a lot of pain in those men. Nicholas Eberstadt, as a man, as a human being, truthfully, no BS, how much emotionally does this bother you and how much does it affect you, if at all?
It infuriates me. I mean, it's so needless. It seems to me that it's so needless and it's so wrong to treat people as if they're disposable. They're our own citizens, and treating people they're our brothers, and treating people as if they're disposable and we can go on without them. It's a formula for failure for our society, and that really bothers me.
Yeah, that was Warren Farrell, who's maybe the world's most eminent men's experts, who described men as the disposable sex. We send them to war, and still only men are allowed to be in direct combat. 93% of workplace deaths occur to men. Men die earlier of all 10 of the top 10 diseases. We die 5.2 years younger, and all you see is efforts on women's health. All you see about is women's unemployment, and men are really the ignored disposable sex. Do you think that's fair?
Men are certainly stronger. They're certainly physically stronger, and I think that there is a strong impulse on the part of men to protect, and maybe sometimes men need to be protected.
Good point. Okay, you as an individual, you said you've been at this computer game and you love it, this data game, for 30 years. You are a named scholar at the AEI. You've written a number of books. You've had supreme education. You're now probably in your 50 or something like that.
60.
You're 60. You're old.
Sorry.
No, I'm in the same category. What is next for you if you're being circumspect? There's a tendency for stasis, you know, especially after all these years in one field and you like it. What, if any, changes, incremental or radical, should you be contemplating? I'm a career counselor, so I like playing these games with my guests.
Right. Interesting.
What thoughts are, you know, incremental and radical potentially for Nicholas Eberstadt?
Well, incremental is just doing more of what I love doing, which is stumbling over things which are kind of hiding in plain sight. This men without work problem that I've done this book on is a problem that's hiding in plain sight. There are lots of other ones, and I keep on bumping into them. But part of what's really really fun for me is the secret weapon in our home is my wife, Mary Eberstadt. Mm-hmm. She's the real talent in the family. She's a writer and a novelist and a playwright. She's got a play coming out a little later on this month here in D.C. And so, so being part of that, sometimes being Mr. Mary Eberstadt is one of the cool things I get to do in my life.
I want you to stay on you for a minute. There's a tendency that's a very nice, polite thing to do. You know, I know you're in D.C., and every politician, when they step down and say, I want to spend more time with my family, or it's a team effort, it really isn't me, it's my wife, I want to thank, I wanted you to talk about you for a moment.
All right, well, I'm Mary. About me. I mean, I think that I'm going to keep on doing these sorts of trying to uncover big problems that people are kind of overlooking. One of the ones that's on my docket right now is the family structure in China. I think the family may be disintegrating, eroding in China, and it's always been the basis of their way of life and society, and there may be big unexpected consequences of this, possibly. I want to do stuff on Africa, because Africa is going to be the biggest growth of human population in the next generation or so, and the well-being of people in Africa is going to be immensely important to all of humanity. And probably some things that I haven't even stumbled onto yet.
I'm not a big stumbler. I'm kind of a planner. So I'm going to flesh out both of your two ideas and tell me which you like better. You're going to find a Chinese partner because, you cannot, as a white guy from America, you need to find a brilliant Chinese partner who lives in China, who is immersed and is smart, thoughtful, mm-hmm. knows both cultures, and more in a more focused way, look at what really is happening causally. It's easy to do correlational statistics, but to try to get out of your statistics and do maybe a more anthropological analysis mm-hmm. of what is really going on in, say, take a dozen families that are mm-hmm. representative of maybe you can't cover the whole country. It's a billion country of a billion people. Yeah. But just take Beijing, so you've at least controlled for the geographic issue. And look at a dozen families in Beijing for a year each and send some graduate student researchers, some interns or whatever, to do some good anthropologically oriented studies at what's really going on in those families. Maybe a time series design, do some interviews from 10 years ago, what they were like 10 years ago, how it's evolved, what they project for the future, and then you analyze the data. What do you think about that idea, first of all?
I think that's really hard, but I think that'd be great.
Okay.
I think that'd be really cool.
I'm out of time, so I got one more quick one. On the Africa thing, look for success stories. Right now, we all hear about, take Nigeria, which has got the highest standard of living. Take 10 families that have risen from the depths of poverty to those that have risen, and ask them, try to dig out what are causal, what differentiated them from those that did not rise. What do you think about that?
Excellent idea also. I mean, but I think both of those would be really cool.
Cool. Well, it was really cool having you as a guest on my show. Nicholas Eberstadt is the author of Men Without Work, America's Invisible Crisis. It is well written. Probably Mary, his wife, wrote half of it. Who knows? But
she's a better writer.
Anyway, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
It was a lot of fun for me, Marty. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was fun. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers, and I'm really going to have fun with the next week as well on a much lighter topic. I'm going to be talking with Dick Gutman. Who is Dick Gutman? He is the publicist for Barbara Streisand, for Jay Leno, and a whole host of some of the most famous people in Hollywood. In that series I'd call What's It Really Like to Be, I think that's going to be really an interesting conversation. We'll learn about the career as a publicist, as well as some of the inside information about what those people are really like. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
The archives of Dr. Marty Nemco's articles, information on his 8 books, including his new book, The Best of Marty Nemco, plus how you can consult privately with Marty, go to martynemco.com. That's MartyNemko MartyNemko.com. And join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemko here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.